Of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Anna Dean Silver from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Out in the Garden. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the book Way to Garden by Margaret Roach. It's a hands-on primer for every season. And we will start with the introduction. And that's beyond outdoor decorating. A garden without a gardener is a jungle waiting to happen. But a gardener without a plot to till is likewise a very sorry sight. This book is about both sides of the equation. The delicious organism that gardener and garden, once united, quickly become as they ride the peaks and abysses of what the weather and life dish out. In this, the 21st anniversary edition, the book is also about what happens when you stay in one place and keep digging holes, as I have. This is a basic garden book, but then again, it's not so basic. It supplies guidance to those looking for the way to succeed with tomatoes or prune a hydrangea. But it also shares guidance from the other side of the equation. Advice and insight I have gotten in return from my plants. By becoming a gardener, I accidentally, blessedly, landed myself in a fusion of science lab and Buddhist retreat, a place of nonstop learning and of contemplation, where there is life buzzing to the maximum and also the deepest stillness. It is from this combined chemistry that my horticultural how-to and woo-woo motto derives. On the second half of that equation, I think of my garden and myself as the two main components of the same organism, like the Jerry Maguire character played by Tom Cruise, who finally professes to exhaust Renee Zellweger, "You complete me," though I did not resist surrender anywhere near as long. That perspective makes me think about the gardening year in a way that may at first seem a bit unfamiliar or even odd. I imagine the garden year as roughly parallel to the six seasons of my own life, from conception through birth and on to youth, adulthood, senescence, and finally death and afterlife. Moving from phase to phase, take months or years, if all goes well, in the case of a human. In the garden, it's all packed into a single year and then starts over and over, even long after the gardener is gone. In my system, each phase is roughly equivalent to 2 months. For example, conception is January and February, a time when we are conceiving of the garden by planning on paper and ordering seeds. I've tried to cover each subject within the section of the book corresponding to the time of year when the information would be most useful. So preventing spindly seedlings is discussed in birth, March and April, and sowing the fall vegetable garden is covered in adulthood, July and August. By the time we get to death and afterlife, it is November and December, and we gather up the year's debris and make compost, one form of eternal life I feel certain of, and carefully store away saved seeds, another way that next year's garden rises up out of the one gone by. I find this anthropomorphic view of the garden comforting, a handle to hold when trying to remember what to do when reviewing the incessant chores list. It also reminds me that this gardening stuff is not just a hobby, like building model airplanes or stamp collecting. The medium is alive and also changing, and no, you are never really in charge for a second, no matter how straight your rows nor sturdy your staking. Something larger is always at work, something no mere hand of a gardener can control. How I came to garden. I came to the garden in my 20s at a time when things were not going so well in the people parts of life. My new friends, the plants, helped me through a long spell facing an impossible responsibility: how to ethically, sensitively care for a parent who would never get well but would live a very long time. Each quart pod of some unknown growing thing, at this stage even common names were Greek to me and botanical Latin was unthinkable, gave me a reason to rouse myself for another day. The young plants needed me and I them, since unlike my failing mother, they showed promise and possibility. Now, when I conjure in my mind's eye the garden that I made in those 5 or so years before she could no longer live at home, I laugh. Set around the house I grew up in and returned to its crisis after a decades of absence in suburban Queens County in New York City, the nascent garden was, as my late father had always labeled, agreeably eccentric people, a real pep. At the feet of the aged privet hedge, I tried determinedly to coax a carpet of Lobelia erinus, the sprawling lobelia with dark blue flowers normally used as an annual in hanging baskets. There was virtually no spare soil around the privet's roots, but I was insistent on a blue swath the length of the hedgerow and used the strongest, sharpest trowel in the garden to gouge out tiny pockets to stuff the transplants into. A chisel and crowbar might have made planting easier. I was incredulous when the lobelia refused to grow. The little plastic labels imprinted with the pretty pictures said this plant required part shade, and that's what I provided. It didn't mention that 1 cubic inch of loose soil wasn't enough for any plant, or that root competition from a 50-year-old hedge probably wasn't Lobelia's cup of manure tea either. The hedge continued in its role as test kitchen when I took saw and loppers to it in my first attempt at rejuvenation of an aging shrub. The next foundational lesson I tackled in my impromptu home study course in horticulture. My self-taught unit in annuals as ground covers hasn't gone so well. The lobelia didn't even make it a month, let alone become a blooming carpet. But I was undeterred. Caring for the dying had put me in a state of perpetual motion, and gardening was my personal occupational therapy, my sedative. Many years later, when I shared this anecdote in a lecture, an insightful audience member pointed out that I was experiencing horticultural therapy. Yes. Another class in the experimental curriculum that never ends might have been called sculptural plants. for a strippy bed cut out of a steep hillside beside the driveway, I'd chosen a pallet of hens and chicks, Semper Vivum, and red-hot pokers, Nipophobia. And who knows why, but how I loved this peculiar, even pitiful pairing. The lurid orange and yellow pokers jutting upward from the succulents. Perhaps I thought the hens and chicks needed a rooster, and there is something vaguely bird-like about the red hot pokers and the unarguably masculine. How ugly my combination was. How proud it made me to see them grow. Or take my first significant encounter with perennials and with propagation, enduring evidence of which is still inscribed in pencil inside the back cover of my first gardening book, The Victory Garden by James Underwood Crockett. Once I calculated how much it would cost at $3.99 or $5.99 a pot, vintage prices, to actually plant even a modest border, I apparently decided to grow my own from seed. Between the color flower headshots in this book, in his book, and those in the delightful gaudy Thompson and Morgan seed catalog of the day, I drafted a list of a dozen must-have perennials. Leave no color unturned, apparently, was my motto. You may wish to put on your sunglasses to dare conjuring it, even in your mind's eye. Maroon and gold, Gallardia, lavender, Canterbury bells, Campanula, white balloon flowers, Palicodone, reddish pink dianthus, fuchsia bee balm, Monarda, hot red Maltese cross, Lychnis, Chalcedonica, red and yellow columbines, Aquilegia canadensis, pink foxglove, digitalis, multicolored lupins, lupinus, pale blue perennial flax, linium perenni, pansies, not even a perennial, but what did I know, and fire engine red painted daisies, pyrethrum. Ugh, to this day, not a single garden pot or bed of mine has included one of those plants, nor Lobelia and Kinephophia. Proof that the trauma already suppressed remains imprinted on my psyche. I ordered them all and began collecting yogurt cups, milk cartons, and other cast-offs for seedling pots. There was, of course, no spot in the house suitable to support 1,000 plantlets that wouldn't be ready for the open ground for half a year. And what did I know about achieving a long blossom season, or even about the plant's habits or needs? I had been drawn in by all those postage stamp-sized catalog pictures of one luscious flower each, and headlines like, "Extra-large exotic blooms will be the envy of your neighbors, and so easy to grow." I did it all wrong, wrong plants, wrong propagation setup, and I even started every seed in every packet as if I could use 100 or 80 or 300 of something. In those days, results didn't really matter. I was hooked on the hopefulness, the sense that there was something worth waiting for. Another spring, perhaps, or more ripe tomatoes than the year before, I love those spindly seedlings fiercely, and from them learned my first lesson in the life and unfortunately death cycle of plants. Today, new plants at the nursery or in catalogs sometimes tug at me to take them home and love them, but that's no longer really it. What's it is coming upon a twig in the massive old bottle buckeye that isn't a twig at all, but a stick caterpillar disguised by the genius of Crypsis to blend in with its environment, defying predators and munching none noticed. What it is, all the insects who have evolved to take on the coloration of or even the appearance of bees, hoverflies, cirrhids, and some beetles like the locust borer and even the clear-winged sphinx moth, again to say, don't eat me, because a mouthful of bee is apparently not a popular menu item. What's it are the birds who caught on early that I offered more diversity on my land than the cornfields across the way and became regular visitors, egging me on to learn about native plants, succession of blooms, and therefore an extended supply of delicious insects, seeds, and fruit, so that I might in turn be accompanied on my rounds by their songs, their distinctive behaviors, their flashes of color. We have grown up together, the garden and I, and now we approach growing old together, too, with bits falling off here and there on both of us and others not working quite so smoothly. It is about 40 years since I tortured that first flat of lobelia. These days in the garden, I have had for more than three decades in the Hudson Valley, a couple of hours' drive north of that first experiment. I try to be kinder, with respect for what the world has given me, and I never grow seedlings without a proper light source. What follows are some of the lessons I've learned so far regarding plants, processes, tricks, and most of all, a lifetime supply of wonder to nudge you beyond approaching gardening as merely outdoor decorating and to enrich the seasons of your garden and your life. And we start the next chapter, which is conception, January and February. A new cycle, a new season. I lay no claim either to literal ability or to botanical knowledge, or even to the best practical methods of cultivation. A woman of great gardening wisdom once began an essay, and that was fine for her to say, because it was humility, pure and simple. But if I tell you that in my case, these same claims do indeed hold true, you can trust it. I mean, a painting of modest Gertrude Jekyll's well-worn gardening boots hangs in the upper crusty Tate Gallery in London. Somehow I doubt that my sorry L.L. Bean specials will ever make their way to anywhere but the local dump. But what I do share with Jekyll, regarded as most responsible for the renaissance of classic garden design in the 20th century, whose writings I could read and read again, and I trust that you too, is a wonder at the very existence of plants. How can it be that they have such intricate beauty? Have you ever seen the clever paintings that live inside a flower? How is it that so many garden plants can disappear come winter and then from nowhere reappear in spring, unbeaten by having lived like bird's eye vegetables in the earth's own freezer month after frozen month? How can it be that a border of daffodils blooms each spring in the woods above my rural home, though the people whose house they once adorned are decades gone? And why does a tomato smell great and its foliage just smell? And why aren't every plant's leaves the centers of photosynthesis, the color green? It is this natural curiosity coupled with the needs to touch and smell and otherwise get to know these living things that counts first and foremost, all manner of scientific degrees notwithstanding. I want to tell you where this instinct of botanical wonder came from, at least in my case, about the zinnias my grandma Marion cut and stuffed into the fiesta-ware bowls of water, flowers that picked up the brightest flecks in the old linoleum of that kitchen painted walls and ceilings and cabinets in yellow high gloss. I want to tell you everything to talk to you about the image of the iron padded chaise beneath the old contorted wisteria at Grandma's too. They plopped me on that chaise for my birthday photo, while all around me wisteria pods fell to the upholstery canvas and the state slate patio beneath. Manna from heaven. Happy birthday, Margaret. Welcome to the garden. Digging down deeper into the psychological subsoil will take some time. All I can tell you now are fragments like that one, flashes of memory, moments of recognition. All I can say for certain is that it is gardening that I love more than anything else I've ever found. And here is a simple example of the reason why. Just the other night, I reached into the freezer for a large container of tomato junk, a hodgepodge I use as the stock of my winter diet. It is a commingling of whatever edible was still standing and producing when first frost closed the last season down, tomatoes, beans, parsley, kale, and squash. There, like a reddish brick of ice in my hand, and then a few hours later, in its next incarceration as the base of lentil soup, my garden was with me again. Gertrude Jekyll is uncharacteristic, immodesty, called herself a garden artist. But do not look in this place for any such lofty figure. Simply, I like two things very much: the smell of freshly washed laundry and the smell of warming earth that is hit by a rain shower, properly called petrichor. Hence, down deep, I am part washerwoman, part ditch digger, and thankfully, it is a true symbiosis. The former helps undo the filthiness, the latter reeks on the hands. No, neither my garden boots nor my garden are the stuff that art is made of, a fact for which I am only partly apologetic. My garden is where I can be myself, perhaps the only place besides the pay-by-the-hour couch that invites me to be so, in fact. This is where I think big, where I overdo it, where I don't turn inward and downward, but really stretch myself. Damn the insecurities. In the untidy maze of garden this wintry weekend, the zinnias will be waiting, dried and shrunken to a dilapidated state of brown, contorted by months of cold days and nights, as Grandma's wisteria was by age. I did not cut my zinnias to fill the bowls my ancestors did, at least not in the season's final month. In my kitchen, the bowls hold shallots and garlic, a blue hubbard and a buttercup squash, all destined for the winter kettle. my zinnias doornail dead, and there nearby the coneflowers and rudbeckias and all have a higher final purpose. To the birds, each dried seed head is a mini feeder, and as the sun comes up on these frigid mornings, I am content to sit and watch the goldfinches having at it, bursting from one botanical snack bar to another with zeal such as I only feel when, to tell the truth, I never get quite that energetic anymore. My bird feeding next to my gardening is what amuses my friends most, though frankly I see nothing funny in it. I know when other gardeners checking balances are finally spared the gardening season's near daily drains for pots and plants and seeds. There I am in my woolens, hurtling up to the Agway farm store, possessed by a mantra of seed sale, seed sale, seed sale. When others are clipping supermarket coupons to spare the household budget, I am urging the birds to eat, 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 in hopes of moving one hole closer on the Bird Seed Club punch card to that as yet exclusive free 20-pound bag. We are building a habitat, an old friend used to needle, impersonating my voice and using my very words as we dig yet another hole for a berry-bearing shrub or drive yet another feeder pole into the good earth. But underneath the kidding, we knew it is the magical intertwining of things that gets to me. We feed the birds in the lean times. They eat our bad bugs, and thus there's a harvest. And the bottom line is that it is what I am doing when I am gardening, building a habitat. It is a place for me and for my friends, and for our friends, the birds and bugs, and yes, even the blueberry woodchuck, who rumbles down the hillside from time to time in fair months in search of a refill for his sagging belly. Lately, it has been the place for a hungry stray farm cat, too, a truly wild creature, and when I throw a little stone close by to chase him from beneath my sacred feeders, I feel a twinge of sorrow, for after all, he is just trying to join in the cycle, too. And The next title is Studying the Catalogs. And we'll probably finish this one in the next program, but we'll start. The cheapest gardening education can be had in the pages of plant and seed catalogs. If you're not welcome the new year in possession of a pile on the bedside table and another on the dining table, make it the first resolution to order some now. And we've run out of time for today's episode of Out in the Garden. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Anadine Silver, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Out in the Garden is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.